Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Previously on Lost.
Do you really think all this is an accident? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, John?
The island.
They've attacked us, sabotaged us, abducted us, murdered us. We're not the only people on this island, and we all know it.
So I guess I'm out of the book club.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back. We have to go back.
We're going to need to watch that again.
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost rewatch podcast for season 3, episode 8, Flashes Before Your Eyes. I have a question for our hosts, as I always do at the beginning of every episode. How many ounces of McCutcheon whiskey is your life worth? My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I think at least 2 or 3.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I don't know how to answer this based on the fact that I think whiskey is disgusting, even extremely expensive whiskey.
And I'm Neil Miller, and here's the thing about whiskey. I agree with everything Joanna just said, and so my life is worth every single one, because you can burn it all for all I care.
Okay. Plus one. Me.
Well, I'm glad to be the host that's quantifiable this episode.
Yeah. Dave's like, 2, maybe 3? And we're like, light the whole thing on fire.
Burn it all.
Dave attempts to answer the essay question, and Neil and Joanna question the premise. I like it.
Sure.
It's a good episode of Lost to be doing that. If this is your first time joining us, maybe because we got through some tough parts of season 3, you should know that we're a Lost Rewatch podcast. Lost was a show that aired on ABC for 6 seasons. We've been watching one episode a week since season 1, episode 1, back in 2019, and been doing podcasts for each episode. We split those podcasts into a couple of sections. One is called The Calm, and that's if this is your first time going through Lost. If you are a Calmie, then you are coming across some surprises about how flashbacks work in this episode. It's going to be really cool. You could stick around for the first part of this podcast and not be spoiled for anything beyond season 3, episode 8. We're going to have a interview this week, which is usually calm and will be calm this week, with the inclusion of our trusty beep button to beep out the spoilery things. Joanna, who are you talking to this week?
We got Griffin Newman. You have heard his Blank Check podcast co-host David Sims on this podcast a couple times. Griffin wanted to join the party. He did his homework. He watched all of the Desmond episodes to prepare to talk about this Desmond episode. So that was Griff's journey. He said he hadn't watched any Lost since the finale aired. And then he watched just the Desmond arc because he loves Des and wanted to talk about his favorite. So we will be talking to Griffin about all of that. It's a really fun chat, spoiler free, but yes, you will hear some beeps. That's it.
Well, I mean, and then at the end of the show, we have our second podcast section called The Storm. It stands for Storm of Spoilers. That's what we used to be called. We were a Game of Thrones podcast. It's a really funny joke based on the title of a novel that isn't really relevant to Lost. But here on the podcast, that's where we get to talk about this episode of Lost in the context of all 6 seasons of Lost without any beeps. If you look down at your podcasting device, there will be time codes where the calm starts after this, wherever we are right now in your podcast, where the interview starts and where the storm starts. That's how this works. If you want to support the show beyond what you're doing right now, and we thank you for just listening and joining us on this rewatch, you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and become a monthly subscriber at many different levels of donations. At the lowest level, you get access to our Slack and our podcast series, Feels Like the First Time. This is a podcast series that Joanna started with Kristen Russo of the Buffering Podcast. And Kristen took a break, and some of your Storm hosts and Storm podcast producers have been filling in. Joanna, what do we have coming up next with Feels Like the First Time?
Oh, I don't know beyond what we're currently in the midst of, which is like we're in a little X-Men segment. Our producer Diana had never seen an X-Men property, so we watched X-Men First Class with our listeners and our Patreon. We watched two episodes of the X-Men animated series with our listeners, and then Diana will be watching Logan, and then we will be talking about it. So that's open to our Patreon subscribers at any level. You can join us there. X-Men First Class was in our secret movie club, which is at a slightly higher level. But we are just watching stuff all the time as a group in that Slack. It's just like a daily party, where Neil is watching Avatar: The Last Airbender for the first time with everyone, two episodes a day. We watched an all-time classic episode with the Killer Jam secret tunnel, featuring in it, in our Slack. So if you go to...
It was like a cave of history.
Uh-huh. If you go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers and you join up for our Patreon, you can just like hang out with us basically all the time because we're all in our houses working and not going to bars. So hang out and watch some stuff with us. It's a good time. You could do that. You can go to stormpodcast.com to check out our latest, schedule of what we've got going on. You can follow us at Storm Podcast, where we vote on like our weekly Jungle of History poll and all that sort of stuff over there. Or you can email us, host@stormpodcast.com. I've got a couple great emails for our Storm section this week. And then you can also always, of course, leave us a review. I got a quickie review to read this week. This one comes from Absolute Bill. 5 stars. Love this podcast. Love the weekly sword fights between Neil and Dave while Joanna interrupts with her giggles. So that's a review that we got this week, and I'll take it.
accurate depiction of podcast.
All right. So that is it for me this week. Neil, yes. What happened on Lost this week?
Well, this episode, Flashes Before Your Eyes, was directed by Jack Bender, and written by Damon Lindelof, friend of the pod, and Drew Goddard. It has a runtime of 44 minutes, and it aired on February 14th, 2007. That is Valentine's Day. That will come in handy later. It takes place on day 73 on the island. We begin at beach camp, where Desmond, after making a weird face, runs from the jungle back to the beach and miraculously saves Claire from drowning. Charlie and Hurley feel compelled to investigate. And over a bottle of McCutcheon, previously mentioned, they interrogate the timey-wimey elements of Desmond's story, leading to a very interesting flashback. In Desmond's flashback, we are building a mystery with Desmond and Penny, who are, at this point, just a cute couple who are trying to figure out where to live and whether or not her horrible father will sanction their marriage. The dad is bad, the numbers are there, and Desmond can't stop remembering the island. And then a strange lady shows up and tells him that he can't stop the future. But he might try anyway because he loves Penny and is a really good guy. It all ends with the revelation that Desmond hasn't been trying to save Claire this entire time. He's been trying to save Charlie from an apparently inevitable demise. Boom. Lost. Fun fact for this week's episode, Charlie's middle name, which is on, it's on the sign, right, in the flashback, is, Hieronymus. This name is a variation of Geronimo, as in Geronimo Jackson, or Jerome. Its origin is ancient Greek, where it means sacred name.
Ooh.
Yeah. This week's calm question, as I mentioned, this episode aired on Valentine's Day, 2007. Theoretically, would watching this episode of Lost have fit into your 2007 Valentine's Day plans? And I'll go first to give you an example. I think that I probably did actually watch Lost on Valentine's Day 2007. Because I was living a good, solid, happy single life in 2007. So, but I'm curious to know what you guys think. Dave.
Up to you. I don't think I was watching Lost. I don't think I was up to my, watching Lost, time in my life yet, weekly. Mm. But, it was what, February 2007 would have been like my senior year at NYU in February. So I probably wasn't like doing much. And if I correctly am remembering who I was dating at the time, I almost guarantee you we were at some sort of weird off-Broadway theater as like a Valentine's Day thing and not by the TV at all.
All right. That's where I was going, trying to get with this one. Joanna, what do you think you might have been up to?
I'm looking at what movies were in the theater for Valentine's Day 2007.
Dinner and a movie?
Yeah. I'm a dinner and a movie person, I think, for Valentine's Day. And like, I don't know. So, Bridge of Terabithia, huge downer. Not going to see that. Ghost Rider, not going to see that.
Oh, yeah.
Norbit, yeah. No. Music and Lyrics, the Hugh Grant classic, probably not. This is a weak ass year.
Yeah, 2007 didn't get good.
That sounds like a
till later.
Yeah, that sounds like a weekend that Norbit won almost without question.
Probably. Anyway. So, sure. Stay home and watch a lot instead of those movies. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I don't know. Do you feel like there is any intention there of this being like the Valentine's Day episode? I don't think Lost ever cared about that, but it is kind of fun to like that it's a Penny and Desmond episode.
Yeah. And it might have been because as we've, you know, sort of discussed on this podcast, they bifurcated this season so they would have some more control over when the episodes air. So I wouldn't put it past them either.
I'm going to say this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a spoiler to say it. You guys can decide. The next Desmond episode, which is arguably the most famous, inarguably actually, the most famous Desmond episode.
Sure.
Also aired in February.
Wow.
So maybe they were trying to do something like
that. So February was just sort of Desmond's time.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, we've got one couple that everybody's rooting for.
Yeah, we have one good couple and then a bunch of like trying.
We had a fine couple and then we got Juan back into the sun flashback or whatever.
Are you guys tired of Jack and Sawyer and Kate? Are you guys really, really still annoyed over Shannon and Saeed? Well, we have something for you, a Valentine's Day treat. It splashes before your eyes.
Yeah, and I think it actually could have worked like that because there's not a ton in this episode that places it in this run of season three. Like, it doesn't specifically have to be here. This could have been episode three, and I would have been fine with it.
This is the closest I think Lost comes to, at least to this point, to like almost having a bottle episode. I mean, of course, it's serving to fill in gaps, but it's sort of, you know, even in my intro, I didn't really mention anybody else, even though they're in that beach scene at the beginning. This whole episode revolves around one story. You know?
And we also like it, with the only thing that I think sort of timestamps it is the Saeed and Locke stuff, which is basically there to timestamp it and otherwise like doesn't provide any forward motion. They're exactly where we left them off. They buried Echo, Locke saw a weird thing on the stick, and now they're going to go somewhere else, but not this week. This week we get to flashback to what happened to Naked Desmond. And I think it's good placement because this might be way too early in the episode to bring up, but next week's episode is basically agreed to be the worst episode of Lost. So it's really nice to come out of the first five, which I was notoriously, which I was properly hard on. I don't like any of these turns of phrase. We're in a good episode that has time travel stuff.
We were appropriately unimpressed with those first couple.
Exactly. Three. And like how I always try to, you know, evaluate the flashback versus and how it works against like the main story And with things like Kate, where maybe it's those things get a little confusing, this one's super clear because of its fun little time travel, mind travel. However, Desmond actually gets to be aware of our presence on the island in his own flashback because he turned that that key. I think it really works, obviously, as a twist on how to do something different with the trope that they've now said, like, losses, you know, these cutaways and the main story. But I also think that it's a great sort of freeing idea into some of these other science fiction ideas and these little weird time things they tried to sprinkle out as Easter eggs during the first five episodes to sort of present us with a episode that structure is both contributing to the world building of the show and is completely new randomly on the eighth episode of the third season. So as far as Lost goes, just like as a screenwriting aficionado, this episode is like good in that way. It has a nice little purpose, and it has a good structure that builds into the cuts back into the time jump, and cricket batting out of the time jump just works fantastic with the story, and I think builds the character really well. I think everybody also enjoys this episode, so let me ask a more character-based episode to a question to Joanna.
Me?
Joanna, yeah. Joanna, what do we think? Why do we think Desmond cares so much about what Charles Widmore thinks about him?
Oh, I don't know if you know this, but Lost has a lot of daddy issue stuff, and sometimes it's not your literal daddy. Sometimes it's your like prospective daddy in law.
Perspective daddy. Sometimes it's your perspective daddy.
All the best time travelers have perspective daddy-in-law issues is the point. I don't know that we ever get, I don't know if this is spoiler to say, but we don't get like Desmond's childhood in a way that will help me understand why.
I think we sort of get everything we need to know here in this episode. It's like classism, you know?
Right. Yeah. No, but like what put that chip on his shoulder so hard in the first place? Mm.
Because Penny gives him an out in this episode after the interview goes bad and Widmore gives his whiskey speech. He goes back and basically, you know, says it doesn't go well, but kind of lies to her. And then she's like, well, that's fine. Like, I don't care. And Desmond can't let it go. And it's painfully obvious, especially because at this point, it's been set up as not just a Desmond who does it that first time, but a Desmond who might be aware that he's about to do it again, which makes this whole episode like even more painful, depending on how you see how time works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's got that same streak that Jack has, the not being able to let it go, but his isn't like, I can't let people die and I'm a doctor. His is more like, I need to make an honest, proud woman out of Penny, even though that's not what Penny wants at all. Right? Like, and I think that's one of the sadder things about Desmond's whole story is like, Penny does. She gives him like a bunch of outs here, you know? Like, Penny seems super cool, man. Just chill.
Yep. And then, into Red Ceilings, which I'm not into, but, oh, go ahead.
Chill, but also knows, like, where to hold the line when she needs to hold the line.
Mm-hmm.
Where she's like, excuse me, how fucking dare you? I moved into your apartment because, also Desmond has basically, like, class dysmorphia, right? Cause he's like, oh, my rat trap hovel. And I'm like, that seems like a perfectly nice loft apartment. Like, I'm sure it's not as nice as where Penny was living. Cause Penny is like money. But like, sir, you do not live in a rat trap. My goodness.
Yeah.
So definitely like classism chip on his shoulder about all of that. And it is, I mean, the whole point though is that it is such like an absurdly frustrating, like, he's creating a problem where there is none, right? Mm-hmm. And so that when he finds himself trapped on this island, which we know he did to, like, win the boat race to prove to Charles Widmore that he's good enough for his daughter, blah, blah, blah. Like, Desmond's literally on the island. Like, he got himself to the island through his own, like, bad decision, stubborn, you know, like, toxic masculinity, like, life choices, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, yes, you could argue got all of these people onto the island in the first place. Like, the events that led them to that plane is usually, like, some sort of fatal flaw that they need to work through or not. But Desmond, it's like, it's just so much more direct that, like, you see him. You see that there's no reason for him to have done this. And he did it anyway. And then he's just, like, trapped there underground for years. Years? A year?
Yeah.
Three years?
I don't know.
Long time. Well,
he got too there around when no Juliet reason. Got there, and Juliet's been there for, like, 2 years. So I think at least a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so let's talk about if Desmond could really change time. Here's a question that I'll base it around, and since I posed one to Neil, I'm going to pose this one to Neil. Neil, what really happened in the past? Did Desmond not buy the ring, or did Desmond throw the ring into the Thames? If you were to go back from the end of this episode, like, you're going to die, Charlie, and look at the thing of record, is Desmond having an electromagnetic trip that allows him to think that he maybe had control? And, you know, he meets a nice little subconscious ring lady who tells him some time travel secrets, but ultimately he never bought the ring.
Can I pop the premise of your question?
Sure.
I was reading interviews. The creator said at the time that did not just happen in Desmond's head. What we saw happen.
Wait. Okay. That makes it slightly more confusing. I guess my read of this the first time through of, like, what is this flashback? Because it's obviously different. You know, it's something, it's not quite, you know, all the flashbacks are just there to tell us something about the character that we didn't know, but this is Desmond sort of actively in his own flashback, which is really interesting. You know, like, he figures out that he's living the same thing again, which is new. That's a new trick. And I always read this as, like, this was a communication between Desmond and the island. Like, when this flash happens, all of this information flashes in front of Desmond into his mind. And it's him and the island, talking, and it's the island trying to convince Desmond that he needs to do something, or, you know, it's like, it's some sort of manipulation, because at this point, my frame of mind is sort of John Locke, like, where it's just like, what, anytime, you know, something new and weird and mystical happens, what is the island trying to tell this character? So that's kind of how I read it the first time. So it's like, you know, the island sort of puts him in this electromagnetic mind bubble.
Yeah.
And he has to get out of it, which is him realizing that he's in the mind bubble is him getting out of it at the end. And then what that means for Desmond as far as, like, why he's now trying to save Charlie, essentially, I guess, is more, it's easy to see as, like, oh, now we know why Lost needs Desmond, but we don't necessarily know what this means for Desmond's character just yet. You know?
Right. So,
can I take a swing at answering your question?
Yes. I was going to pivot to you with a point, but yes, go for it. No, okay. I want to hear your swing before I get all over it.
Okay. So, in this episode, we have the example of the man with the red tennis shoes, right?
Correct.
And the idea is, like, he's going to die no matter what, right? If it's not the scaffolding, it's going to be something else that's going to get him, because the universe will catch up to him. He will die. Which we're meant to extrapolate over to, like, Charlie, right? And, like, no matter what Desmond tries to do, lightning rod, blah, 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 to save Charlie, as far as the premise of the end of this episode is concerned, Charlie's going to die, right?
Right.
So what that establishes for us is this rule of inevitability with time travel or timey-wimey jumpiness or whatever in this thing, which is, this is a phrase you'll hear again in Lost, and it's useful for understanding how they think about time travel, but this idea of whatever happened, right? but how did, it's like the execution. How did it happen? So what happened was Penny never got a ring from Desmond. And I would say that in the alpha version of this timeline, Desmond just simply did not buy the ring. But in the beta version of this timeline, where he is working with information that he gained from his time on the island, Penny still doesn't get the ring. He just throws it in the river this time instead. But ultimately, no matter what, Penny was not going to get that ring because she never got that ring. So she was never going to get that ring. That's how I understand time and how it
works.
That's
the lesson. Well, and that's this, it matches the death lesson,
right?
Which is like once your destiny is set in stone by a choice, which in this case for Desmond is choosing not to propose to Penny, then the time will catch up to you eventually, no matter what you do to try to avoid it.
So off that, my query for Joanna still stands. but now it takes on two parts. One, why does Charlie not remember Desmond? And two, did the very fact that they interacted in this bubble universe bring Charlie's future uncertainty into the realm of Desmond's, where it's an eventuality, but it is also something that can be changed? He could stop the lightning bolt. He could save Claire from drowning. Is the fact that Charlie is the only one that from the Losties that we actually see in this bubble flashback important to their future?
I don't know. I don't know that the show is trying to say that is true, but I certainly don't like hate that idea. I don't think it's weird that Charlie doesn't remember him because like
it's Desmond's experience, right?
Yeah, like
I mean, the only thing that I would think Charlie would remember him about is if what we saw actually happened, then Desmond, like, brought up the island and stuff to Charlie, and then, you know, randomly, what, he's writing late on his fingers a couple years later, you think he'd be like, oh, shit, that guy on the busking, but
yeah,
maybe
this
not.
This is what makes me feel like like, Joanna describes as, like, the alpha and beta timelines, but this is, like, a break in the multiverse, where Desmond got sent to a different timeline for a second, and is now back to his regular timeline.
I feel like there's a premise that asks this question later, and the show answers it.
Yeah, I do. I have a storm thought that has to stay stormy about this.
But yeah, well, I also have storm thoughts on this, but I'm glad we could get into it. One more.
Yeah, specifically right here is where I'd like to put the pin.
One more non-stormy question about Charlie, though. Based on this episode and what it establishes about time travel and what we know about Driveshaft and the Lost Universe, can we be sure Driveshaft didn't write Wonderwall? Just saying, I don't think we can. He's not like, here's a hit by Oasis, other famous brother group that I'm busking representing.
With someone named Liam in it.
Yeah. I don't think it was ever a secret that the Lost creators, I don't think, played it like the Game of Thrones creators, where they're like, we don't listen to any fan stuff. I think, they knew. Like, they knew that it's a funny joke. Everybody knows. Driveshaft is like Wonderwall. It's hilarious.
Yeah. I like it.
It's like Oasis, sorry.
They have him playing Wonderwall, which is good. So I was like, maybe this is like an alternate universe or something, like where you all,
sure,
everybody's doesn't happen. But there is an ad for the for Buddy's diapers on the TV show that the soccer game that Desmond's watching. There's also a Widmore Industries ad. There's also an Apollo Bars ad. There's a Hanzo Foundation ad. You know how it goes on Lost.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this. I was pretty sure at the time I watched this that this was some, like, Earth 2 shit.
Yeah. It's a nice twist from Alcatraz Island being the weird thing we were dealing with. Now I feel like the entire structure of our show might have been called into question. And especially when you're talking about something like, as we were talking about with the others, like with Room 23, like we're potentially dealing with an island that has something to do with judging people as good or bad. And we don't know if it's by actions or by intent, but if you suddenly like throw in this weird idea of fate it really changes, I think, how you could judge a person's quality as good or bad. I think it's super positive in the way that, like, I think everybody should take responsibility for their actions, and taking responsibility is sort of just like admitting that it happened and you can't change it, especially if it's an action that you're not proud of. But I also like this way of, like, massaging that theme into the show with the mind control room and the polar bears and the exploding hatch, and now we've got time travel in it. I'm very happy when Lost takes a step confidently into sci-fi. Season 2 wasn't that bad, hashtag. Sweet. How much do we want to talk about the lady from the others who seems to know what's happening to Desmond?
She seems interesting.
It's huge. It's huge that this is in this episode, because, like, mm-hmm. we've never had, even on the island, like, we've had Russo give her, like, idea of what the smoke monster is or what the sickness is, like that, but we've never had someone like so authoritatively talk about the rules of this like world unlike ours that we found ourselves in, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So whoever she may be, she's very like the conviction with which she speaks is very like convincing, and like and so that matters. That matters a huge deal to have this sort of guide type figure. I don't think we've had someone quite like that. I mean, we've had like whatever the Christian Shepherd is on the island and stuff like that, but
everybody else is too busy withholding what they know so far.
You know,
this lady, she's a talker, and that's she just becomes an exposition machine, and it's good. I like that the way they introduce her is in a way that I'm not immediately sure if she's telling anything that's the truth, you know, like, because she sort of, you know, breaks the wall of the flashback. And so I'm still not sure I trust her, but I'm ready to hear her tales.
Yeah. And apparently she has the ability to see across or exist across multiple somethings. I don't know. But just the fact that, you know, she knows, like, this isn't supposed to happen this way.
Right. She, like, was aware of Desmond's presence in whatever that was.
Exactly. You know? It's like, yeah, what Joanna said about authority, we've gotten some of these hints about how, like, the rules of the world from other characters, like, you know, sweat lodging or something, but everybody sort of has to happen across it. And it's sort of a questionable rule, but it is nice to have someone just come and say, like, here are the rules. Mm-hmm. And that person not being Ben, who we can't trust. This person seems like possibly trustable in the sense that the guy with the red shoes absolutely did die. So, as far as we know, shop owner woman, very important introduction, to the world building of Lost.
I mean, there's a lot more we could say if we could say what her name is. But I guess we've decided.
I don't think they say it in the episode.
That's what you guys have decided, but, like, I'm not convinced.
That's true, I couldn't remember, like, to be honest.
I believe
they
you.
Say her name or not. But we'll get to her. Don't worry, she'll be back. She's interesting.
Yeah, I'm going to very quickly search for the name in the transcript of the show I have pulled up for one of our corners, just to make super sure. But I don't know. I mean, we could say here's what I can say to you. She does not introduce herself. If we did say the name and you were a call me, it wouldn't mean anything to you right now. But eventually, I think it'll come around.
I don't know if that's true, but okay.
Really?
Maybe.
Not based on...
Oh, you're talking about Lost's penchant for naming characters after...
Yes.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's try this then. Joanna, who wrote A Brief History of Time?
Stephen Hawking.
Interesting. I wonder if that was directly planted like the other hints about time in episodes preceding this. That would be interesting.
That would be interesting.
All right. I think it's time for some corners. Guys, or I guess we do have a Giacchino corner. I was just going to skip right over it and go to the Jungle Mystery Moment. Neil, fill us in on some Giacchino.
Well, there is a theme in this one, and I'm not entirely sure where it shows up, but I believe it's somewhere in the flashback. Distraught Desmond is the title of it from our sound score lord, Michael Giacchino. It's the first instance of Desmond's full theme. So now that we are through the production break and we, I assume at this point, have confidently signed Henry Ian Cusick to some sort of contract that brings him back for a while, Desmond now has his own theme.
I like Distraught Desmond being the name of Desmond's theme because it really lines up with each time you're going to see it used.
He's having sort of a rough one.
Yeah. He's got an interesting perspective. This week's Jungle Mystery moment has to be one of the classic Lost Outs of all time. You're going to die, Charlie. Because it seems like we spent a whole episode learning that things have to happen. And now, got Charlie.
Do you remember if you, like, did you remember it as you're going to die, Charlie? Or did you remember it as you're going to die, brother? Like, which did you remember it as?
Oh, man, I think I remember him saying Charlie. But that might not be right.
I remember him saying Charlie, I think, because it's very close to the, like, Charlie bit my finger, Charlie, when he says it.
Charlie, you can never come back. That's all dogs go to heaven. All right.
Oh, all dogs go to heaven. Sound mixed at Goldcrest. I know, because I walk by the poster going to work. All right. That's not important. What is important is the Boone Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award. If you watch Season 1 of Lost, you know poor Boone died because he took a big fall. And ever since then, we've been honoring his memory by who takes the biggest and craziest fall. Sometimes it's a metaphorical fall. This time it goes to Desmond Hume, who took a cricket back to the face so hard he fell back into time.
Which is cricket bat to the face through space.
Through time and space. And out of his clothes. That cricket bat just disintegrated all of his clothes in another dimension. That's how amazing that cricket bat was.
Yeah.
Joanna, we have an accent corner.
Well, it's a pretty easy one, right? But like, so Mysterious Lady, she of the expert advice and the ring job.
Miss Steven.
Is played by an actress, Fionnuala Flanagan. So, Dave, I'll start with you. Is this actress's real accent?
I'm going to say no, Joanna.
Okay. Neil?
Yeah, I mean, this one feels like it should be easy because it's the most Irish name of all time. Or Scottish. It's one of the two, but it's very much not British, which I think is the accent she's doing here.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to go with no.
Right. So she's doing like a British accent, but she is very Irish. She is like very politically Irish. Fionnuala Flanagan rules. I don't know, like some folks we were watching with like our first timers, they remembered her most from The Others, which is a fantastic film where she does like a really sinister job. In that one, she got a Screen Actors Guild, nomination, for Waking Ned Divine, which is one of my favorite Irish comedies of all time. If you've never seen that movie, it's a great one. Anyway, she's fantastic. She shows up all over the place. She's like really good at being like kindly is the boring version of her. Like kindly yet sinister is like really her jam. So, that's Fionnuala Flanagan. Fun fact about her. Mm-hmm. Is that she was married to an Irish doctor for like decades and decades and decades. He was a pioneer in the realm of addiction, and he was the founding president of the Betty Ford Clinic. I just thought that was interesting.
Wow.
Oh.
Fionnuala Flanagan. She's a rad lady, and I'm happy to see her here on Lost.
Yeah. Is she rules.
What was the comic Waking of Ned Divine? Is that the naked guy on a motorcycle in the trailer one? Okay, cool. Okay, I saw it. Good. I like it. All right.
Someone's won the lottery, but uh-oh, he's dead. So we as a town have to band together. It's a little Weekend at Bernie's, Irish style. It's great stuff. It was like a real era for like UK comedies of like, this wacky thing happened, so now we have all become strippers.
There's the one where Alan Tudyk takes his clothes off at the funeral, too.
Death at a funeral.
Calendar Girls was the other one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Calendar Girls. There's the one where they swim the English Channel.
Full Monty.
There's Brassed Off, where they're like, we will protest coal mining with brass band, and Ewan McGregor's here. So, you know, anyway.
We just discovered a whole subgenre of European films that I've
favorite. Oh, Billy Elliot's another one. I mean, basically, coal mining's involved. Yeah. I'm interested.
It's like union worker stories in the UK.
I'm interested.
Our Henry Gale Memorial, obviously a lie award, goes to a big lie that is obviously a lie when it's told. Maybe it's just the most ironic statement award, but this case is definitely a lie. Desmond says to Penny after a horrible whiskey lecture from Charles Widmore, "Your father was lovely. We just both agree that I wasn't exactly qualified."
Penny knows it's a lie because her father has never agreed on anything.
Exactly.
We don't have a corner for this, so I just want to call it out really quickly. I am just surprised by how unbothered I am by how they got around their photo issue that they had. Where they had like Desmond and Penny in a harbor, and they're like, we'll just make it like a drop down fabric thing. Done. So we don't have to like match it or anything. I thought that was brilliant. It works really well.
It is great. It's just, and remind me to ask me about that in the storm because I have a question about that photo.
Okay. The other thing I want to say really quickly, and I sent this to you guys in the Skype chat. You remember when, Jon Snow died? On Game of Thrones.
And his
blood pooled into the snow, and people are like, I see a wolf, I see a dragon, or whatever.
I see wings.
What do you see in the pool of red paint around Desmond Hume,
I see an angel's wings.
You see an angel wings.
Like, ooh. A wing, He's you a know, wing. Like coming off of his arm, because it's like just like this, or fire.
A wing or fire.
Am I supposed to do something cool? I see a red smoke monster.
A red smoke monster. Okay.
What do you see, Joanna?
I mean, it's red, so it could be blood, I guess.
Yeah, like, to me, it looks like very, like, deathly and just sort of, like, you know, there's, like, the guy with the red tennis shoes. This idea of, like, red as a repeating motif and death. And, like, it reminds me of, in Buffy Vampire Slayer, there's this part where where the original Slayer says to her, death is your gift. Like, that's, I don't know. I was thinking about that around Desmond. Death is your gift. Like, he has to tell Charlie he's gonna die. Maybe. You know?
Yeah.
But also,
Desmond is sort of like dueling with death. So that's why I'm thinking angel wings. Like,
the fiery
guardian angel sort of situation for Charlie.
It's still just making me have thoughts about physics. Like, how did that paint splatter that way if the spill is facing the other way? And how did he like slide across? And I have questions.
Are you saying this show needs a physicist?
I mean, then maybe that physicist would be able to answer some questions better than I can with, questions about Wonderwall. That's for sure.
Excellent.
Let's all get into quantum theory. That's what we need Dave to talk about. Absolutely not. It's time for the Jungle of History moment. Joanna, where did we leave off last week?
So here's what happened last week. This was the Juliet episode, you might recall. We nominated Rousseau and Ben.
Didn't go so well. 8%
of the vote, believed that Rousseau and Ben, who as far as we know are Alex's parents, should or have smooshed at one point. Carl and Alex, speaking of Alex, Carl and Alex, 13% of the vote. Dr. Asshole Burke and Mr. Bus, 35.5% of the vote.
Yeah, Libby driving the bus.
But fear not, those of you in the mood for Juliet's Avenging Angel style, because Pickett and Juliet's Bullet, 43.2% of the Jungle of History vote. So every week we pick two people or two objects or whatever. Sometimes it's a kiss.
Or two ideas.
Sometimes it's death. Sometimes it's a concussion. So this week,
the show was a lot hornier, like two seasons ago.
Seriously. Now there's a lot more murder. So this comes from mostly from our listeners who were doing our live watch, which we do in Slack every Saturday. We watch every episode, together with our listeners in the Slack. If you go to patreon.com/normspoilers, you can join us. But our listener Adam nominated Desmond and the cricket bat. When the cricket bat smashes Desmond upside, you know, I know he already won the Falling Down Award, but that's also in the Kistery poll. Kat Andre nominated our drunk Losty trio of Desmond, Charlie, and Hugo. Kat suggested they play a sort of spin the bottle with that whiskey they were drinking.
There's only so many statistical outcomes of that.
Cal Magoo went for the, the one that's probably going to win, which is Penny and Dez. It's hard to beat Penny and Dez in a Jungle of Kistery poll. And we came up with Charlie and the Kiss of Death. Because you know what?
This is our ringer for this one.
You're glad to see it. Not because I want Charlie gone, but because, and I talked to Griffin, our guest, about this at length, so it's okay that we didn't talk about it that much, but like, this is a really fascinating way for the show to make Charlie of interest again.
Instead of giving him more heroin, we're gonna kill him off.
No, maybe. We're just gonna hold death over him.
There's a death sentence over his head. And we're gonna see how or when that plays out.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that Charlie finds this out right now. Like, this is a great time in Charlie's life to find out that you should have died twice already.
You're gonna die, Charlie.
I like Charlie's storyline being influenced by Desmond and not by Visions. I feel like it puts us on a much sturdier ground in terms of knowing what's going on.
Motivators that we're looking for Charlie, Desmond, great. Not heroin, not Claire.
Not stealing a baby.
Not stealing a baby.
We're on a great path, I think.
Not building a church.
Joanna, keep it going with the book club, because I do not know what this book is about.
Okay, so first of all, so the book is Laughter in the Dark, which was found in Sawyer's stash. Do you fellas have a thought on how you pronounce this author's name?
Oh, yeah. Vladimir Nabokov?
Okay.
I'm going to go with Nabokov, but Vladimir will stay the same.
Okay. So I believe it's Nabokov. I believe that's correct. But I have heard that instead of like Vladimir, how we Americans think it's pronounced, I was told that at least this gentleman's first name rhymes with the word redeemer. So Vladimir
Nabokov.
So, anyway, it's a book by Nabokov. That book by Nabokov, except not that one, but this one, Laughter in the Dark.
Yeah.
And the significance here seems to be that the book's beginning two paragraphs comprise a prologue, an epilogue, and a summary, giving away the ending at the start, so as not to be what motivates the reader. This is a non-linear storytelling that is something the novel holds in common with Lost. So.
Boom.
Nice.
Where's Libby? Since Libby departed from the show far too soon, we have been deciding where she is in the flashback. Since it's true, she popped up in a lot of people's flashbacks. She's already, gotten Desmond a boat. But in this one, we're gonna say that she has sold her Namaste polar bear art to Charles Widmore. Cause that is a very striking, very island-aware piece of art.
Like, it came to her in a vision, in a dream?
Oh, Dave told her.
Oh, right.
Because Dave is all Daves and knows about the island.
He definitely knows about the numbers.
Yeah, definitely knows about the numbers.
This goes with another fun fact about this one. This is like mini podcast corner, because it's something they did say on the podcast, but we'll get there. But they talked about how the other painting, not the polar bear painting, but the other painting that we see in Charles Widmore's office is a painting that is by Jack Bender, the director of this episode. That's just like a thing Jack Bender does. So this painting apparently pops up multiple times in the show. Elsewhere, I actually think we see it in Claire's apartment in her first flashback. There is a Jack Bender painting that is also then in Charles Widmore's office. And, Damon and Carlton have said that that's not like a connection. It's just Jack Bender's got art and he likes to put it in his scenes. So
he puts it in. Yeah. There are some cool, hints in this Namaste polar bear art, for Calmies. If you want to check it out, you're going to see some symbolism of stuff that's coming up, but also be aware you'll mostly see it with Namaste backwards, which is them flipping the lens again, like they did when they were shooting Ana Lucia in, Australia. So, I don't know if I would take any backwards text as being meaningful beyond that. But have fun. Have fun having a look at Libby's painting. Libby knew what she was painting the whole time.
You do your yarn wall your
that's,
way.
That's right. The official podcast check-in, as Neil mentioned, there was official podcast with Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse. Usually Neil and I do a reading about it. This week, though, they didn't have a lot of interesting things that we did not cover in the calm. A lot of clarifying questions people had about time travel working that they didn't answer. The most notable thing about the podcast for me is they have their whoever's recording them has some banjo sound clips ready to go, and they pretend they're pitching a show called Don't Make Me Play This Banjo, where if someone gets too boring, they just get banjoed off. That's what we need to know about the official podcast check-in. Otherwise, let's get to Joanna's chat with Griffin Newman.
All right, we are thrilled to have on the podcast today Desmond Hume Enthusiast, Blank Check Podcast co-host, and star of The Tick. It's Griffin Newman. Hello, Griffin. How are you?
Hello. We were just talking about this right before
Sorry,
we recorded.
Walked right back
on a relative scale. Yeah. On a relative scale, I'm doing fine, I guess. But you know, none of this feels good. It was very weird watching Lost under these circumstances, and especially this specific episode. And I was a big Lost fan, but I don't think I have seen a single episode since the finale.
Wow.
Like, I don't think I have rewatched a single moment of Lost since it ended. And I would rewatch episodes while it was still on. Like, I had the DVD sets that were favorites that I would go back to. And I wasn't one of those people who was like furious after the finale, but I just kind of felt like, oh, I'm done with this. And I, to prep for this, because I was just going to watch the episode that we picked. And then I was like, it's been so long. The show is so dense. I should try to familiarize myself more. So I watched essentially the Desmond arc.
Oh, wow.
Like, I watched every Desmond focused episode leading up to this. Also because I have insomnia and I couldn't sleep. I just kept on watching more and more of them. But so watching those Desmond episodes like spread out between seasons two, I didn't watch any of the ones that happened after. Was such a weird sample size of different things over the course of that series, and being reminded of things of like, oh, right, there's this big metal door that says quarantine on it that everyone's obsessing over. And so much of this show for like a year was about people staying indoors on their computer in a small room, trying not to go crazy and asking themselves whether what they're doing on their computer is actually helping the world or not. Like, there were all these parallels that I kept on latching on to, and this like desire to get back out to the real world, to stop living in this very small bubble and like re-engage with society at large. There were all these things that kept on hitting me really, really hard.
Yeah, the Desmond quarantine memes were pretty hot and heavy when we all sort of first went into lockdown. His like his hash routine seems very familiar to a lot of us these days. So yeah, it's pretty crazy.
You asked me, like, would you want to come on? Do you have a favorite character? And I, without hesitating, said, like, Desmond. Desmond's my favorite character. And I wasn't thinking at all about what that meant. Like, I wasn't really catching wind of any of the Lost memes of, like, Desmond's resurgence on the internet during all of this. I just remembered being so emotionally involved in the Penny storyline and that being my favorite thread on the show. And then rewatching this, I was like, oh, fucking, why did I put myself through this again? Like, this is too painful to watch all of this. Like, I had no idea that I was going to relate to everything Desmond is going through this hard.
So have you also been traveling back through your own timeline in recent weeks, in Griffin Newman?
I'll say this. I mean, you know, not in a sci-fi sense, but I certainly have been spending too much time in my head reliving everything I've ever done, every conversation I've ever had, every mistake I've ever made, questioning every alternate reality. Like, I'm very much in the real world version of what Desmond is doing right now. Just like questioning every small sort of sliding doors decision I ever made in my
life. Yeah. I mean, I personally think that time you got like a close cropped haircut and bleached your hair was like a real turning point, I think, in your life, Griff. Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that time I joined a monastery and that time I left a monastery, like all that mm-hmm. stuff. I'm reliving over and over again in my head right now.
So you've just done like a brief mini reacquaintance tour of Lost, but this is a big episode in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, Lost wanted to be much more of a genre show than it was even allowed to be in its first season. Like, this is the kind of thing they wanted to be doing. Mm-hmm. I think it's clear when you watch later stuff that both Damon and Carlton, do that, like, you know, the genre is, a heavy favorite for them. And this is like a real dive into the deep end with, some form of time travel. Really, really introduced, for the first time in this episode. How does all of that land for you? And like, how weird is it to think of a version of Lost sort of before time travel was a question we were considering?
Yeah, it's one of those things where like, whatever I rewatched, I guess six episodes, if you count, Live Together, Die Alone as a two-parter, or is mm-hmm. it Life Flashes Before Your Eyes? One of the ones I watched was a two-parter.
Live Together, Die Alone.
So yeah. It was like, yeah. So it was like six episodes I was watching for this, and there was so much stuff I forgot, and so much stuff that in my mind has like loomed larger. So there are scenes that happen after this arc that I rewatched, that I like think about and go, man, Lost was always like this. And then rewatching these episodes, I'm like, no, that was not the main thrust. And then there are so many things that were happening, like, right, there was like so much about the love triangle between Kate and Sawyer and Jack that right. I just completely blocked out of my head. And it's not that I disliked that, but it was just like, it's weird how with distance, a thing that I watched so rapidly, so obsessively, you know, I wasn't as extreme as some people, but I was spending a lot of time online reading Lost theories, talking about it with people, that like in your memory, the scales of what was more or less important and what had more or less real estate on the show totally shifts. And so I think of it as being a harder sci-fi show, even though a lot of that stuff didn't come in really until this episode. Like my second favorite character and maybe pretty close to tied with Desmond is who is obviously like the ultimate hard sci-fi character. He is the character they bring into the show in order to start bringing hard sci-fi into it. But I forgot that it happened that late.
Yeah.
And so much of the sci-fi that was happening in Lost up until was more like genre sci-fi. It's like weird stuff happening rather than where it's like we're actually getting into hard science and the root of what sci-fi is supposed to be. And I don't say this as, you know, as if it's a better or worse form of sci-fi than sort of more like superficial genre trapping sci-fi. But when it really is like isolate a scientific concept and then write a story that is extrapolating how that would affect human behavior, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah,
that's like the basic tenet of what science fiction writing is. It's like fiction based around hard science, or at least hard theoretical science, versus like, where's the polar bear coming from and how is the smoke monster eating people?
Right.
You know? And this is like an episode where that all shifts, where that transition happens. And to some degree, like when I look back on the last couple seasons of Lost in my mind's eye and think about the show starting to unravel a little bit, it's maybe them getting a little too far into some of that stuff, or not knowing how to balance everything, you know, or just too many things have been put on the plate up until that point. And it is a show that overall, on whole, I have a very fond, positive memory of. But I think like a lot of Lost fans who watched it at the time, you were so roped up in the sense of like, where is this going? You know, and every time anything new got introduced, there was the excitement of, are they going to be able to pull off all of this? Like, it was so kind of unprecedented to have a show that felt this dense and this epic and this serialized and this wide-ranging in every sense that kept on seemingly getting more and more ambitious by the week, but remained so largely confident. Like, outside of some clear missteps that they course-corrected, you'd watch it, and I just remember with friends like, I almost always was watching this show in groups with other people, you know, and who I watched it with changed from season to season, but it was almost always a communal social activity for me. And I remember after every episode, us having the conversation, whoever I was watching with, of just like, they might pull it off, right? Like, it was always that feeling of just like, I don't know, like, I don't want to get my hopes off, but they might pull it off. And what I ended up feeling by the end of the run was, they didn't pull it off entirely, but on balance, I think the show was a success. And watching a weird sample of episodes like this,
yeah,
really honing in on one, like, character arc,
mm-hmm,
but also seeing episodes spread out across a couple different seasons, where you're touching on different periods that the show went through, I just, in retrospect, go, like, Of course they couldn't resolve everything. Like, are you kidding me? Like, it made me want to rewatch the show in totality to appreciate just
the
ambition of what they tried to do, rather than criticize it for everything it didn't completely land.
I will just say this. Our last guest on the show last week, Mallory Rubin, who was here to talk about Juliet, the introduction of Juliet's first episode, started a full Lost rewatch after her prep for the episode. So, the, you know, one guest
really
at a time, we'll rope you all in eventually.
I'll say too, yeah, I've had a hard time finding things to watch during quarantine that gel with my current mental state.
Yeah.
Like, certain things are too frivolous and they can't distract me enough from the state of the world. And other things are too heavy and I just can't handle them.
I agree. Yeah.
And I was surprised by how smoothly this went down for me as someone who has almost exclusively been watching sitcoms and cartoon shows for the last 3 months. Like, I have been avoiding things that are this serialized, this dense, this dramatic. And I was totally hooked back in again.
I think the drama, you know, the real human drama, which they do such a good job of nailing, when they do, especially as you mentioned, like the Desmond and Penny connection, that human heart at the center of this genre story, is really leavened by the just like bonkers batshit weirdness that happens on Lost. And so you're just sort of like, you don't have to, you know, yeah, the quarantine stuff is there, but it's not going to pull you all the way down in the undertow, hopefully.
Well, I think that's also, like, on balance, your feelings on how you view Lost as a complete work, you know, whether it was a success or a failure somewhere in between, probably depends on how much you value the emotional human character-based elements versus the larger, more complicated structural mythos sort of storytelling. And the show, what made it so groundbreaking was the balance of the two. And at any given point in time, there was a battle about which one was succeeding.
Right.
You know? Yeah. And the best episodes of the show found a perfect midpoint between the two. I think it's like a great example of that. And I think the whole Desmond arc, when you asked me, like, what would you want to talk about? And I'm thinking about a show that I haven't really looked at in, you know, a decade or even thought about that deeply. That's what jumped out to me. Was just like, that felt like a completely successful aspect of the show with no fat, with no missteps.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah.
I think everything about the Desmond and Penny, and for how much the emotional stakes of it were so high in terms of what they were trying to pull off, especially with a character who was not on the island being the second part of the two-hander, and especially with how complicated it got in terms of the hard sci-fi of it. The Desmond Penny arc is Lost at its best.
I completely agree. One of my favorite things that Damon Lindelof said in terms of, like, I keep hearing these, like, Lindelof jewels that he drops in a mm-hmm. writer's room to guide people. And one of, you know, you say you rewatched the beginning of season two, the reveal of Desmond. The cliffhanger, it's easy to forget. I forgot that the cliffhanger at the end of season one, which is, like, what's in the hatch, was all consuming for people. What's in the hatch? And Lindelof's sort of clever saying around this is that, like, the best answer to a mystery is a person.
Yeah, that's good.
Which is really good. And that Desmond is the answer. And it's not just Desmond. It's like, it winds up being, you know, a guy with a girl back home and that whole emotion around it. Like that's the answer. And that's better than any, like I was a huge Alias fan, for a while. Yeah. And that's better than any like Rimbaldi device. Like the mystery box thing that JJ falls into, Damon's like, what if instead inside I put humans and how they relate to each other? You know what I mean?
Totally. Well, I mean, you know, despite the fact that he didn't really have any hand in the show past the first 2 hours.
Right.
Like, the thing that JJ has pretty much built an entire career on, or at least the most modern, you know, second half of his career, you know, excluding regarding Henry and Felicity and, Gone Fishing and whatever, uh-huh. Right? But that Lost did so well is that feeling of it constantly feeling like something unbelievable is about to happen next, you know? And I even think in like The Rise of Skywalker, for all of its failings, that is what he is trying to do. That sense of just like getting you to trust that the next thing that's going to happen is going to blow your mind. And in some way, you know, emotionally, conceptually, whatever it is. And the experience of watching Lost, and I'm sure like for people who you have on the show who are not watching it for the first time, it's very hard to not slip into like back in my day, do you kids understand? Right. But it was such a specific experience, the show. And I'm not saying it's exclusive to this show, but I feel like it was such, maybe a high point for this kind of like experiential viewing. The fact that the show was so serialized, the fact that it synced up with like full season DVD sets becoming really accessible. So people knew it was possible to catch up with the show. The network wasn't demanding that every episode work as a clean entry point for new viewers,
right.
You know? The fact that they were so deliberate in how they structured seasons, that like they weren't taking weeks off for reruns. They were either doing the whole show back to back to back with no breaks, or they would take one long gap, you know, but then come back in blocks. That it was like you'd spend the year sort of building your brain around when Lost was going to be mm-hmm. airing and when it wasn't.
Yeah.
And every scene feeling like the little drop of water in the desert. Like you're picking apart every single element because you know you're going to spend the next week stewing on that episode, trying to figure out what it meant in relation to everything you've already seen and what it implies could possibly happen next. And the, you know, the cliffhanger of The Hatch was one thing for me, but rewatching this, I had so many moments that felt like Desmond, like shit, where I suddenly was overcome with the physical sensation of how it felt watching it for the first time. Like I remembered in my bones, like how my blood felt during these specific scenes, watching them in real time. And just that feeling of, okay, it's been a long summer. Lost is back. It starts up, all these like close-ups and insert shots, this apartment, you know, the song playing, make your own kind of music,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of Lost thing of whoever I was watching it with, maybe this season I'm watching it with my mom and my brother, and us in real time, like going, who could this be? Who could this be? Like, who is this?
Right.
Whose flashback is
yeah.
this? You know, the show has worked on such a specific format up until this point, and we're already trying to do the math, like three shots in, and we're like, we have to get one step ahead of this show. We have to figure out whose daily routine we're seeing and where this is in their personal timeline. And the moment when you realize this is The Hatch was the moment where I feel like this show can do fucking anything. And it does speak to what you're saying, that was like the most exciting answer, you know, that like aside from the larger implications of now we're opening the door to the Dharma Initiative and all this other shit, right? The more exciting part was there's this whole other narrative that has literally been going on underneath the last season of Lost. There has been another guy living his own life, completely unaware of the fact that the show Lost is happening. Like, all we were thinking about up until that point was others,
right.
And people from the tail end of the plane and shit like that. But suddenly it's like, there's a proper room with electricity and a record player, and he's eating, like, prepackaged food. You know,
there's a blender.
Just felt, Yeah, it felt humongous.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that not only was that reveal so satisfying, but that that guy in the bunker ended up being one of the most emotionally satisfying characters in the entire run of the show is wild. I was looking at like a lot of Lostpedia stuff last night. Mm-hmm. And there was some big like fan poll from one of the big Lost fan sites a year or so after the show ended where he was voted the best character in the history of Lost. Yeah. And I think especially for a character who's not part of that original group, it's quite an accomplishment for him to come in that late, represent such a bold sea change for the show in so many ways, and really work that well on like a human level.
Yeah, and I don't mean to like, you know, our listeners will have heard me say this probably every time I bring someone new onto the show, but like, it yeah. blows my mind that Desmond and Ben are both introduced to season two, and the intention is that they would just be there for a couple episodes.
Yes,
and then
yes,
think about
yes.
Lost without Desmond and Ben embedded in the heart of it is an impossibility. So that idea of like needing to be flexible as a storyteller to bend your story to fit like these creations you've made, these characters you've made who are just like so much more alive than some of the other characters that you more carefully planned or thought out, is a fascinating aspect of Lost for me. So
absolutely. And like constant, I had forgotten is like from what is far and away the shortest season, the season that was easiest for them to manage. But it is bizarre to look back and be like, right, even like 15 years ago, if you were doing this show, you had to do 22 episodes.
Right.
And you're like writing them in real time. And it's like the beginning of like writers' rooms responding to the internet and trying to get ahead of things. You know, it wasn't as controlled as shows like this are today, where like something like Stranger Things, they have sort of as much time as they need
right.
to diamond cut out what their season is before they even begin filming, and so much time in post, you know, and then releasing it all at once. So it's really dropping as one extended thought out piece, versus something like this, which is a show that's like ever evolving in real time in positive ways, like Desmond and Ben, like really popping. And in negative ways, we're just rewatching these episodes being like, oh, right, like Libby. Like,
yeah.
that was just
yeah.
a things like Walt just aging faster than they
uh-huh.
thought he would.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many things like that where you think, like, for better and for worse, there are so many things that became important on Lost that were just workarounds to unexpected difficulties. In the same way, there are so many great things that came out of surprising levels of success on things they couldn't have anticipated. And Ben becomes in a way where you're like, it's weird to think that wasn't part of the plan, but it's almost more impressive because Desmond always was kind of a side narrative. You know, he never became
right.
the hero of the show. He never became the main villain of the show. It was always just this thing of like once or twice a season, it really becomes Desmond's game for like an hour or two.
The question I wanted to ask you, one of those areas that they ran into trouble, like, you know, Walt, as you mentioned, is one of them. Charlie is actually, like, I didn't remember this, and Charlie is hard to talk about in, like, a spoiler-free, just up through this episode mm-hmm. way. But, like, Charlie is a character I just remember loving all the way through, and I think a lot of that is, you know, plenty of that is Lord of the Rings splashover, like, I'm uh-huh. in full, like, Dom Monaghan love mode and stuff like that.
And rewatching these, he is such a deeply charming guy. Like, I forgot.
He's so charming, but if you do the yeah. full rewatch, you're gonna like experience oh. some Charlie stuff that's gonna be a real bummer for you.
Joanna, that's yeah. why I didn't remember how charming he is on the show, because I remember being so burnt out by the time
yeah, exactly.
it was done. Yeah.
Yeah. And so Charlie was a real problem for them. And then they like, in season three, they figure something out to do with Charlie, which is to like put this death, this clock on him, and whether or not it runs out, we will find out. But like, there is all of a sudden, like he, like Charlie is now the answer to the mystery, right? And it's like, what's going to happen
yeah.
to Charlie? And that makes him, that saves the character. I mean, it might be too early for some of our first time watchers to feel that way, but I feel that way pretty strongly about him. And this episode is like Dom Monaghan and Henry Ian Cusick submitted this episode as their, like, season three Emmy consideration episode, which I'm surprised for Dom that
yeah.
this is his episode, but, like...
Me too, because it's mostly
it centers
reacting.
Here.
Yeah.
he was like, yes. Oh, well, once I see me play Wonderwall, then it's over. It's over for the rest of you. but I don't know. What is all the Charlie of it all? How does that work for you?
I mean, that was talk about an element that I completely forgot. A, I sort of forgot Charlie was a character on the show. B, like, in a way that's bizarre because something like Nikki and Paolo stuck out so strongly in my mind because of how much it doesn't work that I just forgot the good and bad of Charlie somewhat entirely. Like, it was as I was digging back in, I was like, right, he was, like, especially at the beginning, one of the principal characters. I mean, it really felt like when the show was being promoted, it was Charlie, Locke, Kate, Jack. You know, Sawyer became major, it felt like, due to how much he was connecting with people and how much Josh Holloway was killing it. But Charlie was, like, really forefronted at the beginning. And he sort of also got surpassed by, I think, Hurley becoming more of, like, the fun, affable, likable guy.
Yeah.
In the way they maybe anticipated that Charlie was going to carry all of that weight. I'd forgotten all of that, and so to be reintroduced to Charlie mostly through that plot line, their, like, Hail Mary attempt to save Charlie, which is, like, making Charlie kind of the center of this Twilight Zone episode, where he keeps on reliving near-death experiences over and over again, was very bizarre. But you also can just feel in, even out of context, watching it, in its own sort of nutshell, how much you can tell he as an actor and the show at large are both struggling with what to do with him, that it feels like he's hit a wall. I mean, it's like you said, the thing of, like, feeling for a little period of time like, oh, Charlie is the key to everything. Charlie is the mystery. That's one of those other conversations I remember having on a weekly basis, along with, are they going to pull this all off? Is maybe the show is all about this, you know? There were so many times where something would become prominent and you would go, like, is the entire show about the fact that, like, Walt read the thing in the comic book and then it happened? Like, is that going to be the key to everything? Is baby Aaron the key to everything? You know, is it this Charlie death thing? Is he the ultimate sacrifice? You know, is it all about, like, this narrative ties around whether he lives or dies? Like, is he the thing that's throwing the entire universe out of balance? I guess it worked. I mean, as you said, like, I'm jumping back in at a weird point where I'm only watching them trying to solve the problem that I forgot existed, you know? So I'm not rewatching the episodes where Charlie is really working as a fan favorite, but I'm also not watching the episodes where Charlie starts to get stuck in a rut. I'm just watching them trying
to... Steals a baby. It's awful.
Yeah. There's just, like, a lot of stuff like that where... Yeah. I think especially if you're writing a show as you go along... You make those miscalculations and then you forget, like, oh, it's hard to come back from this. It's hard to get the audience back on this guy's side.
I mean, I think being this, like, you're going to die, Charlie, or you're going to die, brother, whichever one he says, like, that has to be an all time, like, TV Hail Mary to save our interest in a character that has just, like, burnt out our interest. So, there's that. The other thing is, like, you know, so this is the most that they've delved into the question of time travel. It won't be our last time travel episode, but what is on their shoulders for this episode is to create the rules around time travel so as not to completely obliterate their ability to tell stories in the future, right? And so they come up with this move. I don't know that it's articulated this well in this episode, but essentially the theory for time travel in Lost is whatever happened, happened. In some way, it'll happen one way or another. That's what Eloise Hawking basically says about this guy, right?
In a way, I know this isn't fine time travel, but it is Final Destination rules. Right. As Desmond puts it, the universe will course correct itself. You know, you can only avoid the specific means to an outcome, but the outcome is inevitable.
There's just the question of trying to put stakes on something and, like, if we've got characters or a character or a situation where we can time travel, what's to say we can't just go back and undo everything? That's poison for good storytelling, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
this idea of like, I can't stop it. The wheel's already in motion and I can't stop it. Whatever happened, happened. And that's something I really value that Lost got out right in front of. I don't know, like, how much, I know you're a comic guy. Mm-hmm. How much are you a Drew Goddard guy?
A big fan. Big fan.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is Drew and Damon working together for the first time ever in their careers.
I totally forgot that. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So yeah. this is a Drew co-written episode. And I mm-hmm. think the, like, something that Drew Goddard has always been really good at, is making film and television that feels like a comic book should.
Yeah.
And, you know, not that Damon's not great at that too, but like Drew has a particular genius for it. And so this feels like such, I can see the panels of like Eloise Hawking and Desmond like walking through his life and looking at things and her explaining things. Like that is such a comic book move, as far as I'm concerned. So
it is a really, really good balance of those things. And it was where it felt so exciting as a dorky person to see the show getting dorkier and dorkier in terms of what it could start putting in the frame, in terms of taking bigger genre swings. And, you know, it's easier, I think, to sell certain genre elements when it's wrapped up in mystery. Because mystery is pretty universally appealing, mm-hmm. and especially when you have such basic, engaging human drama on the forefront. But the second you get into, like, characters discussing theories of things, as you said, that's often a harder pill to swallow in a mainstream way. And Goddard is really good at making that stuff feel accessible.
Okay, we will hear more from Griffin Newman, uncensored, spoilers a-go-go, in a bonus episode that's going to hit our feed later this week. But until then, Griff, where could they find you?
I can't imagine anyone feeling like they need to hear me speak longer after this episode, but I host a podcast with David Sims called Blank Check, where we go over directors' filmographies. We pick a director and go through all of their movies, and we're doing why am I forgetting? Nora Ephron right now. Robert Zemeckis coming up soon. But you can check that out wherever podcasts are found. And I was also on the TV show The Tick, which I continue to promote over a year after it got canceled, because I'm very, very proud of it.
It's a great show.
Thank you.
Lovers of all, like, that's Nestor Carbonell.
Francois Chow. Oh, and Nestor Carbonell. Yes. There are a couple Tick crossovers.
Both.
Yes.
Yeah. But right. Nestor Carbonell showed up for the first time last week, and I was just shrieking Batman well into the chat, and people didn't care as much as I did, but I do care. So.
And has Pierre Cheng showed up at this point?
Yes. Yes.
Right. Yeah, so Pierre Cheng is my stepfather on the Tick, if that is incentive to watch the show.
All right, now is the time on the show where we like to thank our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. We've got some newcomers this week. Just loving seeing all these new folks just joining us for all of our watches. Thank you guys so much. Amy Meek, the lovely Miss Jenna, Nick Mendoza, Elizabeth Stelner, Ainsley Clark, Shayna Drake Kelleher, Avindal, Rebecca, Nicole Capus, Natalie Olivas, Stuart Wynn, Erica Sonstrom, EW, oh, Entertainment Weekly, wow.
Yeah.
or maybe it's just ew. Nicole Havelka, Tony Livingston, Fahim Ibrahim, Lauren Galbraith, Ali Karaka, Ryan Cassis, and Suniva Agard. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to add to that thanks Jessica Parton, Christopher Mack, Paul, Jennifer Carnevale, Alejandra Pozos, Sarah Fittenmore, Nikki Hyde, Damon Van Vuren, Michelle, Josh, Cheryl Nelson, Mary Henderson, Amaru Luz, Vanessa Marshall, Seth Freelich, Corinne Ball, Jessica Scott, Matthew Wilson, Sarah Cooper, and Jeff Libby. Thank you guys so much.
Seth.
And I would like to thank the following humans: Amy Harper, Ryan, Kat, Matthew Munden, Mark Rodriguez, Jessica Trowbridge, Jay Forness, Patrick Bratton, Melinda Lim, Francis Adrian, Kevin Gonzalez, Jay Maggio, Eric Rosice, Arthur Wynn, Scott Rumsey, Richard Hoska, Tracy, Luke Sweet, Sheila Curran, and Nate. Thank you all very much.
Eloise Hawking is the name of the person. He is the Penny's half brother's mother.
What?
Yeah,
that's right. I remember.
All right, yeah. So she's Daniel Faraday's mom.
That's right.
Charles Widmore.
Yeah.
Is the daddy.
Oh, can I start with the thing I was going to say where I wanted to put the pin?
Let's put all the things, yeah.
Yeah, okay. We'll start the storm there, because the Charlie thing, not waking up, I think, you know, especially in the context of having gone through the finale recently, where the whole idea of, like, the flash sideways is that, like, these you know, Desmond's there to wake people up, sort of thing. So I feel like my mind gravitated toward that on this rewatch. Well, I'm like, why isn't Charlie waking up? Why isn't Charlie waking up? But this feels like a very baby version of what they get to eventually. You know, like I really honestly always read this as like Desmond, there's a whole different timeline that he visits, for instance, or like it's like a purgatory type thing. Not purgatory, like literal purgatory, but like a inter sort of stuck in motion sort of thing.
I mean, that's sort of the question I want to ask, which is, are we doing a flashback? Are we doing the constant in which Desmond is able to take information and set up a call with Penny? Or are we dealing with the Flash Sideways universe where we know Eloise Hawking is the person who knows what's going on?
I think it's the same as the constant, because that whole, like, him passing out with the paint, like, that's constant stuff. That's him flashing in and out of timelines. So I think it's constant stuff.
Yeah. So, but then how do we...
Maybe this is like level one, and then like the church level is level two. You know, like where we get to at the end is like the next level of it. Yeah, it's really hard to reconcile the two ideas, which is like the idea they're working with at the end with the flash sideways, and this, which feels... Well, different.
What's interesting to me is, you know, Griffin said a couple times in our conversation that, like, the reason Desmond and Penny comes out of this, like, sort of untarnished is that they're never really, like, centralized to the plot. And that's not really true. Like, Desmond and Penny aren't, but, like, they really try to make Desmond central in the end. You know, like, he's the one who, like, pulls the cork out of the stopper of the, you know, fountain of goop and all that sort of stuff like that. Like, they try to make Desmond important in the final season. It just doesn't work at all. And I think that's because Desmond's story is over the minute he finds Penny on that boat at the end of season four. I think it's the end of season four. Like, that's his arc. Desmond's arc is getting back to Penny. And then they've got a cute kid named Charlie, but like every attempt to pull Desmond back into the plot after that does not really work as far as I'm concerned. And so, but they tried because he was such a fan favorite. And I understand that you want more Henry and Cusick. You want to put him back on the island. You want to take the buttons off his shirt, stuff like that, like all of that. But, and so when you think of Desmond and Penny, though, you think of this closed loop arc, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then them in the church, but like them living on the boat and the shooting in the harbor and all that sort of stuff that happens in later seasons, it just doesn't really, it does not sticky in the way that like Desmond wanted to get back to Penny, the constant, and then finally getting to see her on the boat does, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think that this episode sets that up. It sort of almost is where they start to write themselves into a corner, because they, now the thrust of Desmond's character, like, we are in full speed toward, we need to get back to Penny. Like, this, the Charlie thing is going to be a really interesting, like, diversion part of that, but even that is still sort of on the way back to get Penny. So yeah, I agree. Like, once Desmond and Penny get back together, that maybe should have been the end of Desmond, but I don't know. We can revisit that later.
Have him show up in the church or whatever.
Sure. Desmond is always very, like, guardian angel-like to me. Like, he floats outside of the story of the survivors that ultimately end up in the church. And he's there, yeah, like, because he's good-looking.
So, here's...
The future prompt, because they have... There's so much meta talking to the audience about how time travel works on Lost in later seasons. It's all almost entirely Hurley playing dumb and Miles sarcastically explaining it to him. Like, that's how they handle explaining the rules of time travel. And it works a treat. It's fantastic every time. But the big sticking point in the later season is, like, why doesn't young Ben, as an adult, why doesn't he recognize Saeed? Cause it's not even just like Charlie encountered Desmond on the street and Desmond said some shit to him about an island. Saeed kills Ben. And the reason why is he's like dropped in the pool so he forgets everything. But like basically they were like, don't worry. Like Miles, like, don't worry about it. Like whatever happened, happened. Ben's not going to die because Ben didn't die. But like maybe he might, you know, it's just sort of like, I don't know. It's,
and that's why I think that we actually spend this episode in the Sideways universe. So in terms of if we line up how Desmond interacts with the Sideways universe in season 6, it's as he gets closer to the light, he's able to see more of it to the point where right when he's about to be lowered down, he tells Jack that it exists and that he's finding people there. So I think the more that Desmond is...
I think you're misremembering, honestly.
Okay. That misremembering what which part?
Because Desmond, that's not quite what happens in terms of the timeline of Desmond like waking people up in the Flash Sideways and stuff like that.
Well, he's waking people up in the Flash Sideways, but right before in the finale, they're about to lower him down into the cave. He's tying the rope around himself and he's telling Jack like none of this matters because I've seen this other place.
But he's already made that revelation. Like, I know you just, not to, like, pull rank or whatever, but, like, Widmore puts him in, like, a microwave. And yeah, that's what...
That exposes him to the electromagnetism of the island.
Yeah, but then, like, he spends, like, he's down the well, he's doing all this other stuff, and it really has nothing to do with him, like, getting closer to the light. It was that electromagnetic shock, but it's not really, like, the lowering down into the cave that gets him to better understand the nature of the Flash Sideways. He's already had that revelation.
But why doesn't he tell Jack before then?
Because the plot needs him not to.
Desmond
in the final season makes no sense because he's just wandering around with all this information that he just doesn't share, and he's like down a well and he's missing, and you're just like, what's going on with Desmond and why?
The on island, it's easy. I often forget what happens to Desmond on the island. Like in the Flash Sideways, he's like the important, you know, touching everybody on the shoulder, being like, hey, wake up, this is fun. Yeah. But like, you're right, on the island, he does spend several episodes stuck in a well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, because Widmore has to charge him up and then hide him from the Man in Black, but it doesn't work and Man in Black finds
him. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's, if we're looking at the whole context of the show, this flash to something new might be like, it feels on its way to
there's no way in my mind
quite like exactly the Flash Sideways yet.
There's no way in my mind that Eloise Hawking's a god though.
Like, well, I think she just has better control of the same powers that Desmond has.
Yeah. She's a little bit more one with the magnetism
with
force.
The force time stream or whatever.
This is her trick. Waltz is I can speak through the computer, and this is Eloise's trick.
I think someone that has knowledge of multiple timelines doesn't shoot their son.
Well, that's a
she felt like she had to shoot him because she did shoot him.
Right. Well, she does get to keep him in the Flash Sideways at the end. Yeah, I mean for a little while longer at least.
Yeah.
So she's just trying to spend more time with him before he
this
ultimately moves on.
The Flash sideways doesn't exist yet. Like, that is created by Juliet and...
Yeah, in the incident, which is then contained in the hatch, which is what Desmond triggers when he turns the key. It's all the same energy. It's the Flash sideways energy.
I know it's the same energy. I really see a stronger line between this experience that he has through time and the Constant than the later season stuff.
Yes, because I think, you know, like, as you were saying, for a reason why it doesn't make sense in the sixth season, it's because they wrote it that way. But in terms of what we know about what Desmond's capable of changing in time and not changing in time, and then stuff like meeting Charlie here, like, Charlie's never dunked in any memory-erasing water that we're, like, aware of. And so it just makes more sense, given what we know. Because otherwise, he is in real time. Charlie forgets, it's fine. He's not in a great place in his life anyway, so who would care about a busker guy? But it also means that Eloise has gotten so far by, like, 1996 or whenever this is supposed to take place, has gotten so far into her island loop that she's aware that there are timelines she's not conscious of that have happened already. Like, she knows Desmond's in his second loop. Which, the only way she would know that is if at some point she had, I guess, researched who he was and, or no, at some point in the past, in the future, Faraday learns about the ring and writes it in his notebook that then gets passed to his mom. That'd be the only way she would know, right? Or does she know because at this point Widmore is also trying to get Desmond to the island because
my understanding of Eloise Hawking and her, like, godlike powers, is that she gets the journal from Daniel, and that combined with some sort of island mystic mumbo jumbo allows her, like, in Faraday's notebook, it says Desmond Hume will be my constant. And that means definitely that Eloise Hawking's like, cool. Who's Desmond Hume? Yeah. Let me know everything the fuck I need to know about his life. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, to me, it presents as when you are able to engage with the energy that lives at the heart, you know, like at the heart of the island, I guess, you're able to move somewhere else, you know? And like the ultimate somewhere else is the Flash sideways and moving on. But I think that, like, Eloise can move sort of on her own. Like, she's either attached to Desmond now because of the fact that he's part of, you know, that's the whole fate thing. It's like, because Daniel Faraday wrote that Desmond was his constant, now her fate is aligned with his and she's following him through time as she moves as well, maybe. I just think that there's, like, the Flash sideways, where Desmond goes in this episode, all the mystical shit sort of lives in it, like I said, like an energy bubble in the middle of the island, you know, underneath the little plug thing, or maybe somewhere else.
Like, the incident is the most consequential event in the series because it locks in so many loops that we have to do. And it isn't until after the incident that we're even introduced to the Flash sideways world, assuming that Joanna's right and I'm wrong about this episode, which sort of means, like, everything in that loop is the what happened thing. We know for sure because we've seen all sides of that loop. Mm-hmm. So
maybe
I guess
this is just a smaller incident. You know, like, all of these electromagnetic incidents are causing some kind of time-space distortion. The big one breaks it harder, you know, because it's, you know, love.
Yeah, because it's love.
Because it's like heartbreak and a nuclear bomb.
Yeah, it sinks the island and sends everybody off to purgatory.
Sure.
Oh, that's the thing that's... So in the Namaste painting in Charles Widmore's office, the island appears underwater and the statue is fully there, much like how it appears in LAX Parts 1 and 2, which is interesting because I don't think they knew they were going there yet, but go art! Sweet.
Apparently, Damon Lindelof described... I'm trying to, like, figure out what we know about Eloise Hawking's, like, quote-unquote, powers.
Mm-hmm.
And Damon Lindelof described her as a temporal policeman. Mm-hmm. So, like,
sure. That seems like a godlike,
like,
power, though.
That almost feels like she's, like, describing her as being summoned into someone's timeline. You know?
Yeah. I think this is like him hopping back on his own timeline. And that's, I'm sure plenty of our listeners are yelling at us that like Dave's right or whatever. And hopefully you will email us.
I don't know if like from a production standpoint they were entirely sure, but you can see the seeds of different ideas here.
I don't know. There's just like a few paradoxes similar to this that the show could never really fully reconcile, though they try to get away with whatever happened, you know.
Yeah, and that's what I like about this podcast. You guys just wait till season 6B. This is what all the storms are going to be like. I'm going to be like, here are the rules as I understand it. And someone's going to be like, no. I'm going to be like, let's fight about it. Joanna, you said we had some emails, some stormy emails.
We do. This first one's a correction from Jeff. And he said, during Storm of the latest episode, one of you, Dave, said Daniel Faraday always knew his fate, but accepted it and went to the island anyway. But isn't Faraday surprised his mom kills him? He says something along the lines of, you always knew and you let me come here anyway. I'm sorry if this comes across as snooty. Actually correcting, it just seemed a big difference in character, and I wanted to mention since this came up as part of the D&D alignment chart discussion. So
it's Eloise who knew.
Right.
Yeah.
Not necessarily Daniel.
Right. Okay. I don't remember saying that, but I probably did, because dumb.
You're not
It's just a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff going on. You know?
Okay.
Well, and Faraday is just like a memory for me right now. We'll get there.
I'm excited for you to like watch later, Lost. So there's this email from Bex, and I know the answer to this, so I'm excited. Bex writes, I keep thinking about it every time you mention Hydra Island. I'm wondering, when Ben moves the island, does Hydra Island come with it, or is that station and the cages, etc., abandoned forever? I know it's overdone, but I never get to say it, so see you in another life, brother. Alright, so, yes, Hydra Island moves with the regular island, because it is a huge part of the final season. They go back and forth to Hydra Island multiple times, and the Ajira flight that they take off, on, takes off from Hydra Island. The
runway,
they're
building right
is
now.
What, yeah, Sawyer and Kate were building for that plane. It's a big thing. It's all part of the, like, honestly, one reason I think that Ajira lands on Hydra rather than the main island, is the annoying jiggery pokery of the final seasons keeping Sun and Jin apart for as long as they do. I honestly think they're like, well, how can we possibly do this if they're all on the same island? And it's like, oh. Remember Hydra Island? Anyway.
Remember that other island we have?
Because I don't think they go back to Hydra Island before the end. Like, they go back into Room 23 and stuff like that. That all happens at the end. But they don't go back there to the bear cages.
Yeah.
Until
like it's
all
not
of that.
In, like, season, any of the season 4, season 5 stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
All right. And then this is a long one from Grant, and it is about Flashes Before Your Eyes. And he says, I cannot let Flashes Before Your Eyes go past without talking about the crazy theories it spawned for me back in the day and maybe what it means for the series as a whole. This episode from The Jump feels so essential because of Desmond's ability to interact with his past, but also because it featured someone who knew what was supposed to happen to Desmond in that past. Based on this episode, I started to think that Lost is going to attempt some time travel mythos that were based on actual physics due to references to physicist Stephen Hawking. I learned about phrases like closed time-like curves, the chronology protection conjecture, and the Novikov self-consistency principle, and thought time travel could be an explanation for what we perceive as fate on the island. Basically, my crazy theory was that the mysterious energy, described as exotic matter much later, within the island allowed for time travel, and that would have facilitated characters traveling to the past, which would have explained why it seemed like fate required our faves to be where they are. Miss Hawking, the mysterious lady who seems to know what is supposed to happen to Desmond, explains that time has a way of course correcting. when someone in the past or present tries to change a predestined future as defined by Lostpedia. This is an actual conjecture from Stephen Hawking related to general relativity. In 1992, he wrote a paper proposing a chronology protection agency that prevents violations of causality, or rather paradoxes. This is sort of a personification of the elements of physics that make time travel paradoxes impossible. The idea is this. If you travel to the past, you can't do anything that will prevent you from traveling to the past to begin with. Not that you can't act of your free will, but that the universe itself will prevent you from violating causality. Stephen Hawking famously dismissed the possibility of time travel because we are not currently plagued by time travelers. Seems reasonable, right? He even threw a party asking for time travelers to show up and no one did. I didn't know that he did that. That's pretty cool. Anyway, in the Wikipedia article on this topic, I found that some solutions for general relativity allow for the creation of closed time-like curves within a bounded region of space behind an event horizon. Reading about that had me thinking about the island this way, existing within a bloody snow globe, as Desmond put it. For Stormy listeners, we later find out that the island does have some sort of horizon like this, and Faraday and the freighter crew know you can only get to and from the island on specific course bearings. What Hawking described as the elements of physics that prevent paradoxes, the chronology protection conjecture, was also explored in the 80s by a Russian physicist named Igor Novikov, who proposed the self-consistency principle, that it's impossible to create paradoxes because events that exist on a closed time-like curve are guaranteed to be self-consistent. You can't change it, as Desmond says. At the time, I was absolutely convinced that we were mistaking fate for a time travel self-consistency conundrum, and in some ways we were. Stormy listeners know time travel plays a big role in seasons 4 through 5, so events had to proceed in such a way as to ensure their self-consistency. I emailed you previously about a block universe that contains all events at all times within it. Think of how the 815ers caused the incident and had always caused the incident, which eventually leads to the 815 crash. But this is all the science-y explanation for things, and not the faith-y explanation. And after this episode, we know Charlie's supposed to die, and the universe tries to kill him repeatedly. If we put it in the greater context of time-traveling characters, Charlie had to die to bring several of them, namely Faraday, to the island. So the enforcement of self-consistency relates to time-travelers from future events, freighter folk and some 815ers, that rely on Charlie's death to move to the past. In other words...
Charlie always died the way he did because Faraday has the notebook that he gives to his mother.
And, like, if Charlie doesn't die the way that he does, then, people
then
like,
get, like
Sawyer
Charlotte.
And Juliet can't go back in time to where
Correct.
They go. Okay, so Grant wraps up. Regardless, I loved how, in some ways, Lost followed some pretty specific and realistic rules related to time travel. Much of the show was about how the characters' past impacted their current circumstances on the island. It was inevitable that they would somehow have characters interact physically with the past. In Not in Portland, Room 23 told us that we are the cause of our own suffering, which is such a central message of the show. This became quite literal when the 815ers in the past caused the incident which later led to the plane crashing on the island. And indeed, if we look at Lost's as a whole, we see that we can't change our past. Whatever happened, happened, and we are the causes of our own suffering. We couldn't make a new street, a new timeline, no matter how hard we tried. So in the end, we must reconcile our actions and our choices to be at peace. Thanks for listening to me ramble on some crazy psych physics wormholes I fell into because of Lost. As always, I'll see you in another life, Grant. So,
love it.
Yeah. Some real timey-wimey shit from Grant. Love it. Dave, does this, bolster your argument or open avenues of new arguments, or what does this do for you?
I like this idea of a closed loop of it. I am almost entirely with it, except it still makes Eloise a little too powerful for me. See previous Storm comments. But I like it, and I love all that science. It's great. It's like, so after like that 1992 essay that he talked about, was it the CTA, that basically the time cop principle that the universe is going to self-correct? You can see, or you could see if you watch, if you're a fan of time travel media, you could see them transition from Back to the Future to understanding to that as like a way to be like, hey, maybe our story doesn't have to be so clever because maybe time just corrects it. So in terms of Stephen Hawking and what he's like able to do for the way we dig into pop culture, That's one of his essays that really makes a big impact and probably led to him being on The Simpsons, I'm going to guess, just because I remember somebody bringing that up to me in like a sci-fi story, like symposium or something. It's like, there's actually a way out of this. And I was like, oh, damn. So Stephen Hawking, man, keep essaying. Or I guess he can't anymore. Keep publishing those essays, Stephen Hawking's publisher.
I guess there's an interpretation of the show. Because like on the Eloise Hawking Lostpedia page, it says, her foreknowledge of future events based on her encounter with her time-traveling son gave her a somewhat omniscient air in her guidance of Daniel. In 1996, she was instrumental in ensuring that Desmond Hume traveled to the island. So, what this Lostpedia article presupposes is Eloise Hawking, in her guise as ring dealer, somehow, even in the Alpha timeline, pushed Desmond to the island.
Like she was the she worked in the ring shop,
right,
in the Alpha timeline as well.
Right. And she was like, yeah, oh, dearie.
Well, and I think it's,
you can't afford a nice ring. You might as well give it up. You'll never be good enough for her. Better get on a boat.
The idea of connection that they're working with. So yeah, like if Desmond and Faraday are linked by fate or the energy of time or the time force or whatever, then of course Eloise, who's, you know, her whole Flash Sideways thing, powerful as she may be, is just like, I just want to, you know, hang out with my son basically because I feel bad that I killed him. So yeah, that tracks. That makes sense to me.
Like I know that Eloise pushed Daniel to the island, and there is an implication that Charles Widmore also pushed Daniel to the island. That's something that someone wrote in about. What I am curious about, and maybe this is a question that Dave Gonzalez has raised in the storm before, and I didn't have a good answer, and I still don't, but like, how much are Charles Widmore and Eloise Hawking knowingly pushing Desmond to the island? Is Widmore doing this to push Desmond to the island?
Yeah, I mean, that's also an interesting theory because, like, we were talking earlier about trying to explain Desmond's motivation. Like, why does Desmond care what Charles Widmore says? But then we kind of forget that, you know, Charles Widmore just keeps sort of popping up and telling Desmond how to feel about it. You know, especially later. And especially what we see from him, you know, he's trying to get him away. In the first time we see Charles Widmore, he's trying to, like, you know, continue to just pound away at Desmond. You're not worthy. You're not good enough for my daughter. You'll never be good enough. Almost in a way that's like comic book villainy, to the point where you could get there and be like, he might be doing that on purpose to get him away from Penny and to the island.
Yeah. And
so it's not a huge stretch.
If Eloise is part of this and the idea is they both witnessed the shooting of their son in the past and they know what needs to happen on the island. And at least at this point in 1996, Eloise knows about the button, that, you know, maybe installing her in a ring shop that's in between, you know, Desmond's office and his eventual flat is where Eloise has been the entire time, just because they both have to spend all of their energy just keeping Desmond away from Penny. Otherwise, they know all the pieces are going to fall into place because the island has like that pull. Because
the force between Desmond and Penny is so strong.
Right. So
don't
they have
the island.
Hey. They have the constant notebook. And so all they know is that Desmond, it has like this constant time jumpy thing, and that Daniel uses Desmond as the constant. So the only thing they know is that Desmond ends up on the island and not with Penny. And so that's all they're working off of in this one.
What's interesting there's an interview that Damon Lindelof gave Entertainment Weekly. I'm trying to figure out when he gave this interview. He says, unless you travel back in time like Mrs. Hawking does. So apparently she's a time traveler.
She communes with the time force.
Yeah, I guess we never see her go into the island's pocket energy, but who's to say?
I mean, that's the other question is, like, I don't know that we have the full story of, like, what happened in terms of Eloise being a leader of the island, and then how did she get off the island? We don't know that, you know.
Yeah.
Well, we're saving that for the
Lost 2. Yeah.
Great. The Hawking Chronicles. Love it.
Well, you don't get her name until season two, because the whole premise of season one is you don't know what the fuck show you're watching.
Yep.
Backdoor Lost 2. All right, until next week, where we get to talk about a much less fun episode of Lost, Stranger in a Strange Land. Neil, where can people find more of your work online?
Well, you can get me over at filmschoolrejects.com, on Twitter at rejects, and at One Perfect Shot. You can also hang out with me every day watching Avatar The Last Airbender in our Slack, patreon.com/stormofspoilers. And despite what Dave just told you, I would like to also point out that the week after next is a really good episode of Lost. So it's going to be a real roller coaster here for a bit.
One of the best. One of the best.
Joanna, where can people find you?
Oh, me? If you listen to Slash Filmcast, I was on that show this week talking about the film Shirley. You can also find me, on the podcast Truth vs. Hollywood, talking about, films that are based on real life events and sort of how they compare, with Dave Chen. And this week we are talking about The Social Network. So check it out.
Nice.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, where we talk about stuff. There's a lot of stuff about being young parents on this new episode. I'm also there. If you feel like skipping next week, Neil's right. You could listen to Stranger in a Strange Land and then the next episode and be right up caught up with us. You definitely don't have to show up for a bad time, but we will be looking forward to seeing you next week. If nothing else, I could remind you to not fall down.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.